On Robinhood Radio, it's time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage. David is a multimedia journalist with an online column at themediabeat.com and has reported since 2012 for the PBS network, mainly on ethical issues. He is also the author of a memoir, A Question of Paternity, Life as an Unaffiliated Reporter.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning November the 1st, 2024. Here we are, finally, in election month, no longer in just an election year. Indeed, it's a mere 4 days until election day itself. Yikes. That considered reflection is just about the only one left to us at this stage. Back when election year was just beginning, I was in the Media Beat column like hordes of other journalists, writing about the advent of a year of elections, elections in the plural, since scores of countries, as well as our own, were scheduled to be going to the polls in 2024. My hometown paper, The New York Times, headlined it as a year of 50 elections, a nice round figure for a headline, but disappointingly inaccurate, since it erred considerably on the low side. It should have really been more like 60 or higher, and considerably more than that if you count national legislature elections, as well as those to choose a top national executive. I'll make just one note of international comparison. In the forefront of all the many countries holding 2024 elections was India, the world's largest democracy, with more than 600 million votes being cast back in the spring, which took 8 weeks to be fully counted. While saying it's the biggest democracy, we should remember how much its own national media, and the world's global observers too, were saying that the very principle and practice of democracy itself was at stake in those elections, not unlike what's been said right here and now in the US. In India, those doubts and worries were exacerbated by 10 years of incumbency by the autocratically minded ruler Narendra Modi, not least by his blatantly discriminatory policies aimed against minority populations. He decried them often as, quote, infiltrators, the enemy within. Oh, and he enthusiastically hosted a massive rally for Donald Trump during his 2020 visit, held at the world's largest and brand new cricket stadium, 110,000 cheering supporters, many wearing cardboard Trump masks. And I should perhaps add that the Motera Stadium is more than 5 times the size of a piddling Madison Square Garden. But the big surprise result of this year's Indian vote was that, contrary to many polling predictions, Modi's highly nationalistic party lost its commanding control of parliament, the Lok Sabha, and now has been able to stay in power only because it formed a coalition with a minority party. The forces of anti-democracy appear to have been held somewhat in check, for now at least, and in India at least. Here in the US and back at the turn of this year, it's instructive to recall that we were expecting back then that fascism would be an issue. In January, I was indulging in my familiar fondness for pedantry and pointing out that a certain specialist in the field, Benito Mussolini, was to be credited for inventing the term fascist. It's kind of weird now to see in these final days of the presidential campaign the kerfuffle that's blown up over whether Trump deserves that same label, and over the wisdom or otherwise of Kamala Harris agreeing with the word's use and applying it herself to her opponent. It's interesting, at the very least, to see two elevated figures in American politics deciding to make a joint statement on the matter, the House Speaker and the Senate Minority Leader. Oh, let's name them. Representative Mike Johnson and, you remember this one, a certain Mitch McConnell. What brought them together was a desire to call out and condemn what they called, quote, dangerous rhetoric from a presidential candidate. You might have been taken aback by the headline for a moment until you realized they were actually talking about Vice President Harris. It's dangerous, apparently, to call your opponent by that loaded term fascist. It all depends on your standpoint, I suppose. Evidently, it's not dangerous for a Trump-supporting speaker at Madison Square Garden, remembered this week, rightly enough, as the historical venue for an American Nazi rally in 1939. For such a speaker, who is nominally a comedian, we're told, to insult Puerto Ricans as an island of garbage. And it's strangely consistent for Trump supporters to then condemn President Biden for his possibly clumsy effort to turn that insult back on the supposed comedian and his like among Trump supporters. On specifically the fascist label, though, regular listeners to the Media Beat will know I am rather leery about The Economist magazine. I'm suspicious mostly about its often flip arguments in political analysis, but I can admire its writers' frequently snappy phrasing. And this week they've been snappy about this currently heated matter of vocabulary. Fascism and fascist have now well-nigh lost their specificity of meaning, and for many people the words have become in essence just a bludgeoning term of insult. Their use may simply reinforce Trump's people in their vision of him as in some way a victim. The Economist's canny conclusion is this. The F word, as they call it, quote, helps to explain Trump, but it may not help to beat him. It's much more effective, I'd say, as a weary follower of political rhetoric, for Harris to say much more simply and plain-spokenly, as she did at the Ellipse this week within sight of the White House, that Trump, if elected, quote, would walk into that office with an enemies list. When elected, I will walk in with a to-do list. But if Trump is beaten, and especially, though not only, if he's beaten by a small margin, as most opinion polls suggest, we can realistically expect fascism's historic playbook to be vigorously enacted. There will inevitably be legal challenges, however ill-founded, from Trump, and his supporters, with his encouragement, could all too easily resort to escalating force to accomplish an overthrow of the electorate's choice. Those regrouping Proud Boys, to use their own risible, puerile label, and the smaller but all too heavily armed forces like the so-called Three Percenters militia are all standing ready. You may or may not know that the 3% refers to the supposed proportion, supposedly but unreliably supposed proportion, of American colonists who form the vanguard in revolutionary opposition to British rule. There are also, in this context, we shouldn't forget, the Oath Keepers. It's not entirely what specific oath they're keeping, but I know it's claimed to be in support of the US Constitution. In assessing how militaristic or simply violent interventions in the electoral process might be triggered, we have to remember the backdrop of electoral history against which a tight result could unfold. Whichever side wins the popular vote, we can be pretty sure the outcome will be very close in the Electoral College, as it was in both the riotously challenged 2020 vote and the peacefully accepted 2016 result. By bringing up the prospect of violence, am I being overly alarmist? I don't think so. Some of the detailed evidence being amassed by careful analysts, often those not working for the mass media, are decidedly troublesome. The University of Chicago's Project on Security and Threats, led by political scientist Robert Pape, has been repeatedly surveying Americans in general for the past 3 years. And just 4 months ago, perhaps its most disturbing finding yet, was this. 7% of American adults, the equivalent of 18 million people, half of them owning guns, support the use of force to restore Trump to the presidency. Now that may just be armchair bravado being expressed to pollsters. Or it may not. The attack on the Capitol buildings was not launched by 9 million gun owners, just by a couple of thousand people. It's undeniable that many Republicans refuse to regard January 6th as an assault on American constitutional democracy, let alone as an insurrection. Instead, their voices are massed in characterizing it as merely an exercise of free speech that may have gotten a little out of hand. Along with this, much hard evidence is indicating that our organized law enforcement agencies' response to the menace of militants is being disturbingly compromised. There are scattered but numerous instances of police officers, for example at county level, refusing to regard a given passionately anti-government, all-American gun owner as a potential threat, while being decidedly overzealous in suspecting, say, local mosques of being hotbeds of violent militancy. And I can pinpoint a single but possibly emblematic case against a D.C. police lieutenant by the name of Shane Lamond for having tipped off the Proud Boys leader that he was about to be arrested for his January 6 actions. Unsurprisingly, Lamond is also charged with lying to investigators about his contact with and alleged support for that militia. His long-delayed trial is now set for next month, and already the district's auditor has been reviewing whether other city police officers have ties to white supremacist or other hate groups. Elsewhere, a brave pair of political researchers, Emily Farris and Miria Holman, respectively of Texas Christian and Tulane universities, have published a survey in a far-from-mass-circulation outlet, the academic journal Political Research Quarterly. They found that county sheriffs are assiduously being recruited by right-wing paramilitaries and urged to exercise their authority, what the researchers call a mythologized authority, to intervene, by force if necessary, in legal and political processes, if things are not going the way they want. The study focuses especially on how such local officers can undermine state and federal policies, especially regarding immigrants. But the precedent demonstrated here would very likely apply in other serious matters, like civil disturbance in the wake of a disputed election. Next Tuesday should and could be a noble assertion of the people's will for the country that is claimed to be the world's longest established democracy. Or it could be an opening of the floodgates for something a lot less noble. That's all from the Media Beat this week.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.com.